instrument currency, the FAA minimums versus reality. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which is published on the internet, also of Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, as always, Paul.
Bob, let's start out today talking about a safety topic that you are on fairly frequently, and that is the real needs that proficiency dictates versus the legal definition of current. You have an article entitled, "So You Think Your Instrument Current." Yeah, right. Tell us about the incident that inspired this article.
Well, like so many IFR accidents, this particular one that we referenced occurred back in Warrenton, Virginia last year, involving a VTOL Bonanza and an instrument-rated pilot who was attempting to shoot an approach to very low minimums and lost it on the final approach with fatal consequences. And the NTSB probable cause reports that it was due to the pilot's failure to follow published instrument approach procedures and his failure to maintain minimum descent altitude, which resulted in a collision with trees and terrain, contributing to the accident were the night conditions, instrument meteorological conditions. And when we went back and looked at the pilot's own history, he had a fair amount of time as a pilot, but in the last 5 months, he had an IPC 5 months earlier and no IFR time recorded in actual conditions in the previous 5 months, and found himself out attempting an IFR approach to minimums. And per FAR 6157, the recency requirement for IFR flight, he was perfectly legal. And if you looked at him against the FARs, there was nothing to suggest that he lacked the proficiency necessary to successfully execute this approach. But he didn't. And that's why I'm saying that there is a big difference, and I think most of us realize this, between what is legal and what is proficient. And if that difference is too great, then we find ourselves on the short end of the operational stick, so to speak.
Well, I know what your answer is going to be to this next question, and that is, if that's not enough to keep us truly proficient, why is the bar not set higher in regulatory?
Yeah, that's a politically hot question right there. We have organizations, specifically AOPA, for example, and EAA is another good example, who are both membership organizations and endeavor to support the interests of their members. And in so doing, they want to lessen the burdens as much as possible to access to the airways. And sometimes if a training requirement is seen as burden, too much of a burden, they will lobby aggressively to minimize that training requirement if we cannot prove efficacy, for example. If we were to say, for example, we ought to be a requirement to shoot approaches every 3 months as opposed to every 6 months, organizations such as AOPA would say, well, that by necessity would, by definition, would represent a burden to our pilots. And unless we can prove that would actually result in improved proficiency, let's not do it. Well, you know, I would make an argument that on an empiric basis, that more frequently we train, the more proficient we will become. So there is the trade-off. And the trade-off is, the regulations are kept at a minimum level, certainly in the Part 91 environment. And my argument is, and I think to AOPA's credit, is, listen, the burden should be on the pilot to determine for himself or herself what his own level of proficiency should be, and then they should train to that level. But unfortunately, we don't, as we see in this particular example. And then we have another problem. We have flight schools that believe very strongly in the use of flight simulators, mm-hmm. desktop PC simulators, and as a way of maintaining proficiency. And I'm here to tell you, and I'll go on record with anybody, saying they don't work. They do work in terms of teaching procedures, mm-hmm. but they simply do not replicate the what's going on here at our local airport this afternoon when visibility is down to a half a mile and blowing snow. And, well, my critics would say, well, you know, the GA pilot has no business flying in that environment. Well, yes, but we find ourselves in that environment, And if we're there, we better be far more proficient than our last ride on a PC simulator.
Well, and as you pointed out in the past, if you're not instrument proficient in your area, you're writing off, you know, a third or a half the year.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to use our airplanes in this part of the country, we have to have that level of proficiency, no doubt about it, or we will be on the ground.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about a few things that we should be doing to make sure that we are proficient in finding out what that minimum currency level for us needs to be, regardless of what the regulations said as a minimum. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3020.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're talking about instrument proficiency and having a discussion really that impacts proficiency in all areas, not just in instrument. Bob, if the regulations set the bar too low for us to truly be safe, or as safe as we ever can be in a three-dimensional travel medium, how do we determine what it takes for us personally to be ready to fly on days when things are marginal?
Very good question. What we need to do is to take a competent flight instructor in the right seat, we in the left seat, and go out and shoot approaches in challenging weather. Shoot approaches to IFR minimums. We get a number of requests as a result of Over the Airwaves to do accelerated instrument training. And more often than not, an individual will call us from a different location in the country and say, you know, Bob, we'd like to avail ourselves to your training, but we want to be assured that we're going to be able to have actual IFR conditions. Well, obviously, we cannot make that guarantee, but the probability is quite high that sometime between November and April, we will have IFR conditions for their training.
Mm-hmm.
But to the credit of the caller, these are individuals who say, I recognize that getting an instrument rating is one thing, but doing it in actual instrument conditions is an entirely different story altogether. So to answer your question, the only way to gain proficiency is to get in the airplane and in instrument conditions. And do our friends in the South, they can do it too. They just have to get on an airplane or bring their airplane up into the northern climates, schedule their training in the wintertime, and take training not just from us, but any flight school in the northern reaches of the United States. I'm sure there are many that would be more than delighted to provide instrument training experience in real IFR conditions. That's the answer to that question.
All right. What about setting an amount? Is there any way you can set personal minimums in terms of I will not go up unless I've had this many approaches in the last however many months? I mean, how do you plug the numbers into that puzzle?
That's a tougher question. You know, we like to say we train to proficiency rather than in any hour requirement. I know myself, there are times when I'll go 2 weeks maybe and not be on an instrument approach down low to the ground. And if it's more than a couple of weeks, I'll tell you, I get sweaty palms. I can feel that I've lost that sharp edge that I have when I do them, you know, two or three times a week. These skills are extremely fragile, and if they're not exercised every couple of weeks, then we need to get back in the airplane and do it every couple of weeks. Or, and this sounds rather harsh, take a black magic marker, pull out our certificate, and black out the word instrument on the back of our certificate. We ought not be flying in instrument conditions unless we have that level of proficiency. And that's not Bob Miller. Just look at the accident data. The most frequent weather-related accident, of course, is of continued VFR flight into IMC conditions. And when you look at the data, the accidents happen equally to IFR-rated pilots as well as VFR-only pilots. So it is a significant problem. And until we as a group of pilots recognize this and take it upon ourselves to improve our proficiency through additional training, or we leave it up to the FAA to start mandating tighter requirements. Our choice.
All right. The National Transportation Safety Board's summary said contributing to the accident were the night instrument meteorological conditions. How big a part does night play in this? Are there people who are proficient to fly IFR approaches in the daytime who still shouldn't be out at night?
I don't think there's any difference if we're truly in instrument meteorological conditions. If we can't see out the window, then we can't see out the window. The only challenge might be lighting in the cockpit. If we have inadequate lighting in the cockpit and cannot read our approach plates, for example, but that's only for a brief couple of minutes to brief the plate. Then it's committed to memory and we're on the gauges, and the gauges, of course, need to be lighted. So whether I'm doing it at night or in the daytime, I think there's no difference. Again, if we're talking about true instrument meteorological conditions.
I think I know the answer to this question, too, but which would you rather be behind in this situation if it's nighttime? A six-pack, you know, the associated radio navigation equipment, or a G1000?
Okay, that's an excellent question. If you're proficient on the gauges, you can do it with the six-pack just as easily as you can do it on the G1000 glass cockpit. I think if you're less than proficient and you're not flying as frequently or you're not shooting approaches as frequently, I believe that it's far easier to shoot an approach using the glass cockpit. My goodness, you have an 8-inch by 8-inch screen on the right, the multifunction display that's showing your airplane as it comes down the final approach course. And then you have an equally large screen directly in front of you in the primary flight display that shows a huge horizon, blue sky and brown ground. So if I'm not very proficient, I haven't flown approaches to minimums in several weeks, I'd much rather do it on the glass. But if I'm doing it every day, and I'll talk to busy pilots who are out there in older airplanes, check haulers and guys operating under Part 135, they'll tell you, hey, just give me an attitude indicator and an HSI and an altimeter and an airspeed indicator, I can do it just fine.
All right, Bob, we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks again, Paul.
You can read the current edition of Over the Airwaves and find out more about Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Flack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.